Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Hello, and welcome to My Property World. I'm Will Mallard, and I'm joined once again by the lovely Christine Janaway. Christine is a chartered surveyor, an expert in the world of leases and valuations. Her background is all property. She's been an investor herself, and has, like the Monopoly Board, she's moved from residential houses into larger commercial premises. She consults with institutional clients, including large national charities, banks, and pension funds. She also provides a consultancy service on residential leaseholds. And we're delighted to be focused on that last topic today. So you're very welcome, Christine.
Thank you, Will. Lovely to be here again. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Christine, this is an enormous topic.
And, isn't it just?
So residential leasehold, where do we start?
That's a very good question. Where to start? I mean, we could talk for days and days on this subject. I posted in the residential leasehold forum the other day on Facebook. Anyone who's got residential leasehold investments, join that group. It's really good, actually. And just said, I'm going to be on a podcast about talking about residential leaseholds. Any questions you want me to ask or answer? Well, yeah.
The floodgates opened.
A lot. They did, actually. I was thinking, woo, okay. Some weren't questions, some were comments in capitals with lots of exclamation marks, talking about why is my managing agent just ripping me off? They're all a bunch of criminals, they're this, they're that, when are they going to get regulated?
This sounds like quite a civilized group, compared to what I was expecting.
I mean, yeah, for me, it's a fairly dry subject, okay? So I tend to look at it quite technically, the legal aspects, this and that. But obviously, if you have a leasehold flat and you really genuinely feel that you're being, you know, taken to the cleaners, then it becomes a very, very emotional issue. And I do understand that perfectly. So where I generally come in is on dealing with first-tier tribunal applications. So helping clients with their FTT applications to get to try and wrestle the freeholders and managing agents back into some sort of behavior which is acceptable in social circles, put it that way, instead of acting like a lot of them do, which is completely cavalier and they just do whatever they damn well want. And, you know, it's not their money, so they don't really care. And unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because a part of my residential management and lease and lettings business, you know, we do block management, but we do it properly. We do it to the RICS code, how it ought to be done. It's with deep regret, actually, that there are so many managing agents out there who just don't. They just don't do that. And they don't care that they don't do it either. It's sad and demoralizing. Anyway, so generally people come to me when they have problems with the service charge. and say to me, what on earth can we do about this? And there are a lot of things that you can do. But like most things that are worthwhile, they do take a lot of effort and a lot of time. And a lot of people aren't really prepared to put that much effort and time in because it is a lot of time. I mean, I talk about an example shortly of a client that I helped fairly recently. But it's important to remember that the service charge belongs to the leaseholders. The managing agents, if there are one, or the freeholders, they hold the funds and they spend them, but on your behalf. I'm talking to leaseholders now. I'm assuming that the people that I'm talking to have flats and they are upset about the service charge. So that money that you're paying in service charge is actually your money. It's not their money. It's not the freeholders' money. It's not the managing agent's money. It's your money, and they hold it in trust and they have a duty to spend it wisely. Okay. And it is regrettable, as I say, that a lot of them don't do that. So if you're unhappy with one of two things, either the quality of the services or the cost of those services, then there are things you can do, but they do take time and effort and determination. The first thing I would always advise leaseholders to do is, look, you can do this. Get a few of your fellow leaseholders together. Go and see the managing agent. Go and talk to them. You might be lucky. You might have one that's just got a new person in. They don't know what they're doing. Or, you know, they take their eye off the ball. But fundamentally, they're okay and they will sort it out. Generally speaking, that doesn't happen. But there you go. The second thing you can do is form a residence association. Provided there's a criteria about how many people are involved compared to the number of leaseholders, etc. You can find all this on leaseadvice.org, which is the government paid for website about all things resi leasehold. So you can form a residence association, and the freeholder has to recognise you, provided you fulfil the, you can tick all the boxes. And then you can engage actively with the managing agent and the freeholder and try and use persuasion and negotiation. And they know you're taking it seriously and they are slightly likely to take a bit more notice of you, most of them. Some of them still will ignore you, but you've got the right, more rights to challenge things and say, hang on a minute, why are you doing that? Why aren't you doing this? And, you know, that was supposed to be done last year and it still hasn't been done, all those things, rather than just you as an individual complaining. Because as I say, it becomes very emotional. And as an individual, well, they say, don't they, lawyers make the worst legal representation for themselves because they just cannot detach themselves from the emotion of the situation. So you need to be detached. And a residence association is perceived to be more detached by the freeholders and their managing agents. The next thing you can do is you could maybe go down the right to manage route. Again, there are rules about how much commercial element is in the property, how many leaseholders there are, how many leaseholders want to get involved, how many qualifying leaseholders there are, etc., etc. But if you can fulfill those and tick all those boxes, then you have a statutory right to manage. You can apply to the tribunal for the right to manage, and you will then sit in the shoes of the freeholder, effectively managing your block of flats or several blocks of flats or whatever it is. There is a, you know, that sounds amazing, doesn't it? Oh, we can take control, we can do this. But what I always say to people is this: if you're unhappy with the cost of the work, how much service charge you're paying at the moment, and you're equally unhappy with the quality of what's being done, why do you think it's going to be cheaper if you manage it yourself through a right to manage company? Because you're telling me that wasn't done, this wasn't done, the security buzzer doesn't work, the security gates don't lock properly, the car park's not clean, the bins aren't, you know, blah, blah, the lift's not, you know, there's the common parts are not decorated. All those things you're going to then organise, but they're not going to get done for free. You'll have to pay for them. And the way they're paid for is through the service charge. So hang on to your hats, because your service charge in the short term may double. And maybe the what's being done at the moment is being done within the parameters of the money that they've got to do it, maybe, or maybe.
And how do you think the structure of the wider estate can fit into this equation, where you've got different levels of landlord?
Yeah, well, you do the right to manage against your immediately superior landlord. So there's no real trick to it there. And if you've got a discrete block, say it's on a contained estate with several blocks, if you've got a discrete block, you can do a right to manage just on your block. No, and you know, leave the others in the hands of the current managing agent. Then you've obviously got a liaison job to do. So the chances are, if you set up a right to manage company, and then you start managing, you're going to want to appoint a managing agent. So the first thing is, if you think you don't like the managing agent's fees, you think they're too much, you're going to have your own managing agent. And the smaller the block, the disproportionately high the managing agent's fees are. Because there's a certain amount of work that has to be done for compliance, and that costs money. So if you're paying towards managing agent's fees for 100 flats, and then you carve out your block of 10 in a right to manage company, and you appoint your own managing agent, suddenly your managing agent's fees might be three or four times as much as they were spread over 100 flats. So that's, you already thought they were too expensive, but at least they're working for you, right? Not for the freeholder. That's the difference. So you have a degree of control, and you can put planned maintenance. So you can say, well, I know X, Y, or Z needs doing, but actually we're going to do A, B, and C first because it's much more important. We're going to do that next year. So you can smooth out the cost. You can smooth out the expenditure, because often a complaint is, oh my God, I paid so much this year. Last year it was nothing. And now suddenly I've got a massive bill. So it's the unplanned, often it's the unplanned expenditure that gets people really, really wound up, rather than the planned. So to have it planned is far better. And of course, once you've done the catch up, then you're plain sailing, aren't you? Because you've got your planned maintenance program, you've caught up, and now you know you've got a smooth expenditure profile going forward. So you can properly account for your costs, and you know you're getting value for money because you're dealing with it. The directors of the right to manage company.
Tell me, one of the most common sort of thoughts that goes through a leaseholder's mind is why doesn't the landlord want to maintain things properly?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know is the answer. I know that sounds a bit strange, but you would think that the protection of their own freehold investment would be in the front of their minds. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to be. People who trade in the residential management, sort of freehold ground rent market, they're the ones who don't seem to care. They buy and sell ground rents effectively. It's a pain. They have to put a managing agent in and deal with the
So obviously, like, they make money from ground rent. So having sustainable tenants is a big part of that.
Yeah, hopefully not for much longer.
They can make money at the sale, or potentially the renegotiation or extension of the leases, and then they can make little pieces off kickbacks from things like insurance or getting control of management contracts.
Yeah, exactly. They also, another big area of income is where people want to do something like they want to install a new kitchen. That would count as a structural alteration. When we talked about commercial leases, structural alterations with the landlord's consent, exactly the same. There'll be a fee for that. You'll need a license for that to alter, and they'll charge you a fee. It might be several hundred pounds. So this is another reason why you need to read your residential lease just as carefully as your commercial lease, because you'll find anything you want to do. If you want to sublet on an AST, Some leases say, oh, you have to pay an annual fee of £200-300. Well, that's just money for nothing, isn't it? Quite honestly, from the freeholder's point of view, that's just, they've got 100 flats and they're all on ASTs. Well, that's 300 times 300. That's a lot of money. So they, that's another way. And the other way the freeholders make money at the moment is there's obviously the, they buy and sell ground rents. Okay, so, and people often say to me,
so this is where someone has taken a freehold property. There's a, we'll just say there's a block of flats and we'll call it 100 flats.
Yeah. And the freeholder's income is the ground rent and any other bits and pieces they can get.
We'll just say that for the purpose of this, it's £500 a flat per year.
Right. There's another whole area of ground rent levels, which we probably won't have time to cover today, but just be aware that when ground rents go over a certain level, you no longer have the protection of it being a long lease. Anyway, I'll just park that one for now. So they buy and sell ground rents because they're looking for opportunities where they can extract value. So people often say to me, oh, ground rents, you know, they change hands for about 10%, you know, 10 times or even 8%, 12 and a half times the value of the ground rent. Why are they paying that much money? Well, there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, because ground rents are pretty secure, because if they are rent, in inverted commas, remember what we said on the commercial thing about being reserved as rent. So if the tenant doesn't pay if the leaseholder doesn't pay the ground rent, they can repossess the flat. They've got that option. They can notify the lender who's given the leaseholder the mortgage. Say they're not paying the ground rent. The mortgage company have to put that money in to avoid the lease being forfeited and them losing their security, or the lease is forfeited. So they can get the flat back and they can sell it to someone else. So they've got that security, which makes the yield lower. But the other thing they've got is they've got the opportunities in that block, because they will always reserve rights to themselves to build on, in, or around the property. So especially now with the planning being loosened on putting more stories on top of buildings, I think we're going to see a lot more of freehold block owners putting 2, 3, 4 floors on a block of maybe a 6-story block of flats, and they're creating value literally out of thin air. Okay. They are diluting the amenity to a certain degree, I suppose. They might have to put, you know, up the lift, or increase the quality of the lift and the common parts and all that. But basically, if they can create another 6-8 flats, and in London, you know, flats change hands for hundreds of thousands of pounds, not like in the out in the sticks, then you're creating millions of pounds worth of value. Millions of pounds worth of value. So that is reflected in the yield to value, the ground rent. Also, the other aspect of that is, and we're sort of back to valuation now, because as I say, it's all connected. It's like a gigantic jigsaw. That if they own a site and it's got a block of flats on, and they can buy the site next door, they may be able to create extra value by being able to access a site at the rear through the middle of those two blocks. So they're effectively owning their own ransom strip. So that's another way that they can see opportunities in a deal, and that's why ground rents change hands for quite different yields. It seems a bit odd from the outside, but when you think about what they're thinking about in terms of the value of that block, you see the other elements that they're taking into account. Sorry, to get back to the main topic, because I do tend to go off at tangents.
That's the trouble when you've covered so much ground in your career, Christine. All the dots join up.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose the third sort of leg of what you can do, I mean, we've talked about residence association and right to manage, is you can try and go through right to buy, which is the leasehold enfranchisement. Basically, what you're doing then, you're forcing, if you qualify and the building qualifies, then you can go through the process of buying the freehold, forcing the freeholder to sell the freehold. That's the statutory process. It's quite long-winded. It involves valuers on both sides who tend to get into a furious argument about different elements of the valuation. Because again, when I talk to leaseholders, they say, I don't understand why they want so much money for it, blah, blah, blah. But there's four legs to leasehold enfranchisement valuation. There's the term, which is the period. Say you've got 82 years left on your lease. All the leases in the block will expire at the same time, by the way. It would be a mad, insane freeholder who allowed his leases to expire at all random times. Nobody ever does that. So they all expire at the same time. So say you've all got 82 years to go. When you bought your flat, you didn't really buy your flat. People are a bit shocked when I say this. You didn't really buy anything physical. All you bought was the right to occupy that space inside your flat for a certain number of years. And the money you paid up front, the capital sum, is really just rent, all paid in advance. That's all it is. So when you buy the freehold, of course, it's a whole different ballgame because you actually own the building, the ground, the roof, the car park, the garden, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. You own the whole lot. So you can do what you want then, but there are these four elements to the valuation that will go, the two valuers will go through, come to probably quite different opinions about, and then it goes to the tribunal and they say, okay, well, we're going to call it X. And that's what you're going to pay cumulatively. So, you know, divide it by however many to work out each of the people who are involved, because it doesn't have to be all the leaseholders. That's the other thing. But it has to be a certain number, percentage. So there's the term, which is the 82 years, because at the end of that 82 years, if you didn't extend or renew your lease, your flat just reverts back to the freeholder. And you, if you're still living in it, you become an assured short-held tenant and you pay rent, market rent, and you no longer own that flat. That's the first thing. So then you've got the what's called the reversion, which is like year 83 onwards. What does that have a value? Well, it does, but it's pretty slim because basically it's what the flats were today deferred for 82 years. So the square root of not very much at all, to be honest. And then you've got what's called the marriage value, which is the enhancement of the leasehold by incorporating it into the freehold. That's quite a complex calculation, but it's called, I don't know why they call it, we don't call it marriage value anymore. I think that term's been banned. I can't remember what we're supposed to call it nowadays, but never mind. But then you have another very important part of the valuation, which it refers to what I was talking to earlier. If the freeholder owns your block and then he separately buys a piece of land or something next door and at the back, he can create extra value by using some of your common parts, garden or whatever, to create access through to the site at the back. And that element of his loss is called injurious affection, and it's a thing that most people have never heard of and will never hear of again. But basically it's the loss of opportunity to put two more floors on top of your block to create access to a site at the back which would otherwise be landlocked, maybe to do all sorts of things. And he's going, oh, I was going to do this, I was going to do that, and now I can't do that, and I was going to make £50 million out of doing X, Y, and Z. There's got to be a strong intent and demonstration of a strong intent, but there is often an element of injurious affection, and particularly now as the planning rules are being relaxed for putting extra stories on top of buildings. I mean, a freeholder could legitimately say, well, I was going to put another two floors on top of here, and you know, another extra eight flats. You know, you've got to compensate me somehow for that. Generally, the two valuers come to more or less an agreement, but if they can't, the court decides. But the beauty about right to buy, if you can do it, enfranchisement as it's called, is that once you are, you form a right to buy company that holds the freehold, that is the only way to do it. Because if you've got 10 flats and eight of you want to buy the freehold, okay, what you don't do is you do not buy them in your individual name. So you don't say, we are the freeholder, Mr. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H. Because if one of you dies, nobody can do anything until probate's come through. So never do that. So you form a company, you're all directors of the company, and you own the freehold between the eight of you. At your first director's meeting, if you want, you can extend all your leases to 999 years. You can say we're not going to collect any ground rent from ourselves. You can say we're going to widen up the use. We're going to allow Airbnb lettings in our flats. We're going to allow structural alterations just on, as long as you send in the plans so we make sure you're not going to damage the building. We're going to allow this. We're going to allow that. We're going to reduce the cost of this. We're not going to charge ourselves that. But you don't have to change the leases of the other two who did not join into the right to manage company. They still have to pay the ground rent. They still have the restrictions in their lease. You know, it's not a sensible idea not to join the right to manage company. But of course, you have to be able to afford it because it costs. You have to buy the freehold. Don't just get it given to you. So there are huge advantages in right to buy, then franchisement. And then as the freeholder, you can put two stories, or you can partner with a developer and put two stories on top of your block. And the two leaseholders who didn't join in, well, they don't get a share of that profit because they didn't join the company. So you can end up with different people treated very differently. And hopefully people don't fall out. Sometimes they do fall out, which is all a bit difficult when you live next to each other or on top of each other. But yeah.
Now, Christine, there's an enormously complex within residential leaseholds, ground rent, service charges, maintenance.
Yeah.
There's a groundswell of opinion. There's changing legislation.
The Jenrick report. Yeah.
What and the obligations that come with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd love to hear is your view from today, and this of course can change as more information comes to hand, or there's a fresh look at it. But from where you sit today, what's the future of this space? What are the big things that you think are coming up, if you had to hazard a guess?
We'll put all the
disclaimers that you're not the government, you're not responsible for people's
decisions.
But what do you reckon is going to happen?
Right. Well, obviously, we've had the Robert Jenrick's report, and he's recommended leaseholders can extend their lease to by 990 years, no ground rent, a new capitalization figure for leasehold enfranchisement, and all this business. Okay, it all sounds amazing, doesn't it? And I see plenty of people saying, I've got 60 years left on my lease. Shall I, the abolition of marriage value, that's the other key thing. Shall I extend it now when I have to pay marriage value? Because anything under 80 years, you pay an element of marriage value. Or shall I wait because they're going to abolish marriage value? Well, you can only work with what you've got at the moment. A lease is a depreciating asset. And in my mind, the sooner you increase the value of that lease by extending it, the better. Okay, because you can always go back for a second bite of the cherry if these recommendations ever get put into legislation. And I get asked, what do you think the value will be? At the moment, I think I'm going to have to pay X. Do you think but if I wait, then there's no ground rent, there's no marriage value. Surely I'm going to pay less if I wait. And I say, well, hang on a minute. We don't know what the valuation methodology that's going to be imposed is going to be. We just don't know. You might be better off. You might be worse off, actually, because by the time all the heavyweight residential investors have weighed in and lobbied, these recommendations don't have a lot of, they got bits of detail in them, but the valuation detail is lacking. They might have lobbied and got the valuation methodology changed to suit them. So they're actually better off and you're worse off. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but maybe I'm just deeply suspicious. I don't know. I probably am. But I don't think, even with the abolition of marriage value and ground rents going to nil, I don't think that leaseholders are necessarily going to pay any less to extend their leases. I just can't see it. I think there's far too much power in the hands of the big institutional resi investors. they will lobby until they're on their knees to make sure that that doesn't happen. So that is my, if I had to put money on it, I'd put probably £1 on that. Because I'm not a gambler. I just can't see it myself. So my advice to someone who asked me would be just, if you can extend now, serve the notice, extend. And if things change, then you've always got the opportunity to extend to 990 years and wipe out your ground rent. You'll have to pay something else. But I don't think overall you'll be paying any more than you would do if you waited. I don't think so. I could be proved completely wrong, and I will hold my hand up at that point and say, well, that was a bad bit of advice. But I just can't see it happening, quite honestly.
Well, Christine Janaway, you're one of the experts in this space. You've built a sterling reputation amongst both institutional clients and both investors and residential people who leaseholders important to. I really appreciate your time today.
You're more than welcome. Well, I mean, we didn't get to talk about my FTT case that I did recently. And maybe another more opportunities for developers as well. Taking a building and splitting it into leaseholds, best way to do it to make most money and all that type of thing is another interesting topic, maybe.
And I've got a note from a previous session
I said something ridiculous.
No. It's actually so many people look at property, I believe, and you're quite unusual in this regard, where you actually see the wider picture and how it connects up, and knowing when and who to ask what makes it an enormous difference to making good decisions, whether you're buying, you're selling, you're leasing.
Absolutely, because there's plenty of things that I don't know, plenty of things. But I think when it comes to property, I know where the gaps in, I don't call them gaps, deliberate gaps, if you like, in my knowledge are, because I don't need to be an expert on party walls and planning and all that. It's just not my thing. But I know when those people are needed, when their input's needed, to get a full picture of what needs to happen.
Picture, I think, is the topic for another separate podcast. I'm sure there'll be some interest from the listeners. But Christine, in the meantime, someone wants to get hold of you. Your website, what is it? How do they find out more, suss you out online?
Sure. ChristineJanaway.com or .co.uk. I've had that, Gavin. I need to check. Just try both before until you find me. And you contact me through there. My mobile number's on there. People just phone me. My phone is always glued to my side, of course. And happy to chat to anyone.
Okay, so that's Christine Janaway, which is JANAWAY.com.
Yep.
Or possibly
.co.uk.
Well, Christine, once
typical
again,
surveyor, I'm not into that sort of detail.
Absolutely, one of the nicest surveyors out there, and certainly one of the most onto it property professionals in the UK. So you're very welcome.
My pleasure.
I'm Will Mallard. This is My Property World. Thanks again, Christine.
Thank you, Will. Pleasure to talk to you again.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.